This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
The Northwest Indiana Food Council will hold its second annual Farm Hop Series coming up Saturday, August 11th, and again on Saturday, September 22nd here in Northwest Indiana. Learn more about where some of our local food comes from and the great opportunities that are out there for such locally grown food and other products as well. Let's talk with the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council, Ann Massey. Hi, Ann. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, for folks that are not familiar with what Farm Hop is, let's do a little primer first to let them know what a Farm Hop is and the intention behind all of the events that are always circling around it.
Sure. The Farm Hop is a series of farm tours. We have five this year. Last year we had four. And the concept is to allow people, consumers, other farmers, or just folks who are interested in where their food comes from, to get out onto family farms that grow our food. Most of these farms, actually all of the farms, aren't open to the public any other time of the year, so it's a really special opportunity to get to see what they do.
I understand some of these things, some of these farms have a very unique products that they put out or operations they get involved in, so it's great, I guess, to have them around.
Yeah, the Farm Hop this year is really diverse. We have homesteaders who grow things right in their front lawn or their backyard, like completely have filled their front lawn with produce, ranging from really interesting varieties like ashwagandha, St. John's wort, different types of kales and African herbs. I think someone's even growing bananas and avocados. Mm-hmm. We also have conventional farmers who grow mint, tomatoes, corn, and soy. Indiana is one of the largest mint producers, and Wrigley actually gets a lot of their mint extract for their gum from our region.
Oh, really? That's interesting to know, too. We should mention that the Farm Hop series of events happens, as we mentioned, on those 2 days, August 11th and on September 22nd. On each day, there will be from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And let's go down the list here. Let's look first here at the one coming up very soon. On August 11th, there are going to be a couple of separate tours, one leaving from Gary and the other from Valparaiso. Let's go down each tour and talk about them, please.
The tour leaving from Gary will leave from Art House about 9 a.m. Tickets, by the way, are only $20 and $10 for children, and that includes a local food lunch. The one that leaves from Gary, it's really interesting. The first tour, the first stop on that tour is Sojourner Truth House, which they actually just started their garden this year, and they are growing about 3 dozen varieties of vegetables for their food pantry and for their clients who stay at their shelter every day. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful little garden, highly productive. They got about an eighth of an acre going this year, and it's their first year, so it's really exciting to see what they've accomplished, and it's all been volunteer-based. The second farm is A Rose for Yamina Garden, and this is a homestead that is really, truly inspiring. A mom and her five-year-old daughter are pretty much out there every day taking care of the garden. They bring in water with buckets and collect seaweed from the Market Park Lagoon as their amendments for their soil, and their entire front yard is beautifully designed with sweet potatoes, cabbage, kale, tomatoes, fruit trees, lots of different medicinal herbs. I'm really excited to have her on the Farm Hop this year.
That sounds very interesting. Yeah, that sounds like a great urban farm. It's one you don't see with such a wide range of vegetables and other great things to eat. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, about half of her garden is all medicinal, so it's really neat to see and hear about a lot of the herbs that are not common in the U.S. She's really fun to listen to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then the next up is Blind Social Center. They are a social center for the visually impaired, and they have a beautiful garden that is set up for people of different abilities. So the raised beds are wheelchair accessible, and there's tons of flowers. It's very fragrant, and the people there are just wonderful. You can't help but smile when you walk through that garden, and that's where lunch will be served. And then the tour will round out with East Chicago Aquaponics, which is three historic greenhouses in the Washington Park, the three Washington Park greenhouses mm-hmm. in East Chicago. And one of the greenhouses is set up as an aquaponics system, so they raise about 500 or 600 a bass hybrid fish, and the fish waste runs through large tanks to feed plants. And the plants clean the water, and the clean water goes back into the fish tank.
That's great.
And they give away a lot of their produce to the community, and it's a really, really neat place to go.
Now, that's one of the two tours that will be happening on August 11th. That's leaving from Art House in Gary. There's also mm-hmm. another tour that's going to be leaving from Valparaiso. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, this one, for a rural tour, this one is jam-packed. The tours start out at Acorn Acres Farm, which is a family farm that's been around since the 1960s, probably one of the only original organic farms from around here that's survived sort of the industrial farming wave in the 50s and 60s. They are a diversified farm with cows and sheep, pigs, chickens, turkeys. They've got bees, fruits and vegetables, and they sell at their farm store. So they're a really, really fun family to go through their farm. It's a beautiful farm, all organic. And following that, you'll head out to a series of, like, a mini tour within our tour of conventional farms that are all within a couple miles of each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a corn and soy farm, a mint farm, and a tomato farm.
Wow.
And lunch will be at Howe Farm in Crown Point, and they are one of the very few successful commercial hop growers in Indiana. And they supply at least three or four local breweries with hops.
I was going to say, that has to come from somewhere around here. We have so many breweries here in Northwest Indiana that they have to get hops from somewhere. And that's great to know that there is actually a local grower of it, so that keeps them supplied and keeps the brew coming along. That's wonderful to know, too. And that's, again, on the second of the two tours on August 11th. Now, we understand if we have more tours and more great places for three tours, actually, on September 22nd. Let's take first the one tour that's coming out of Gary on September 22nd.
Sure. So we have two tours coming out of Gary. There are well over 40 urban farms and gardens, community gardens in Gary. So it's hard to pack in one tour. So we're doing two tours this year. The September 22nd Gary tour also departs from Art House and will visit Faith Farm, which they have three or four high tunnels covered produce. So they've got an extended growing season and have a really really diverse set of vegetables that they're growing. They're also putting in an orchard and bees and chickens, and they've done this really quickly. I think they're only in their second year, so it's
wow.
really cool to see how far they've come. And then Peace Farms and Gardens, they are in an old armory, a military armory, and they're doing a workforce development program with their garden. And also have vegetables and chickens, and it's a really fun place to visit, too. Stewart House Urban Farm and Garden is a little different. They are a community garden, and people can rent plots. They grow fruits and vegetables for the community, have their own market, and several community members have their own garden plots there. They've been around for quite a while. I think they've been around for at least 7 or 8 years, so it's kind of neat to see their evolution. J1's farm, he's also a homestead, similar to a Rose for Yamina from the first tour, where he's got some really neat innovative solutions for farming on a small plot, the way he collects his water. I know he's growing peanuts. He's got some really cool things on his homestead.
Mm-hmm.
And then that tour will round out with Thea Bowman Leadership Academy. They are a charter school in Gary that has a farming program, an agriculture program for their students with a hands-on learning garden with goats and chickens and vegetables.
That's great. That's great. Now, I know there's a separate tour on September 22nd that is leaving from La Porte, and there are a number of, I guess, opportunities to check out what is going on in La Porte County. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, this tour is really different. I guess they're all really different. I feel like a broken record. The tour starts out at the PAC Center, and the PAC Center is a really inspiring organization. They are run by State Street Community Church. They operate a community kitchen food pantry, and they do community meals every week where anyone is welcome to come. And to support that, they also have their Jackson Street Community Garden, which has plots available to rent for free for community members. They also tend a small space for the pantry itself, and they have a free U-Pick area where anyone can come and pick vegetables that need it. They also have a little stand where people can leave extra produce to share with other folks in the community. And they're working on another center a couple blocks over called Brighton Street Center, where they're going to have a youth training center to continue on the education from the little ones all the way through middle school and into high school. And then that farm will continue on to Tryon Farm, which is a community that is designed by one architect who wanted to honor the heritage of the original farmstead. So the homes are all highly efficient and environmentally friendly. And we'll be stopping at one of the homes within that community that has a beautiful garden full of exotic fruits and vegetables there, and lunch will be served there. And that tour will finish at Rainfield Farm, which is one of the a very highly successful organic vegetable farm in our area that does wholesale to grocery stores and schools. They also have a CSA for the community, and they do farmers markets as well.
That's great. Now, we know we round out the day on September 22nd and the third of the three tours in Valparaiso. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this tour in Valparaiso, it's also got some really fun farms to go to. It starts at Three Boys and Some Chicks Farm, which is it's an absolute hoot because they've got almost 600 egg layers on a couple acres, and they're all free range, and they're very rambunctious chickens. There's chickens on the roof of the house, there's chickens on the cars, there's chickens in the trees, there's chickens everywhere. It's a great spot for kids, and the family, I believe they've got 8 children. They're just big and loving and really clearly love what they do. Then the farm hop bus moves on to Triple B Tilapia, which is an organic tilapia fish farm down in DeMont. And then we'll go to Perkins Good Earth Farm, which is organic diversified farm. And the farmer is actually a soil scientist. So he has a really interesting approach and is a big mentor to a lot of other farmers in the area. And that's where lunch will be served, and the tour will round out at Pioneering Pig Homestead, which is another diversified farm that's got tons of fruit trees, heritage breed animals, goats, donkeys, cows, chickens. They also do bees, and they roast their own coffee. They kind of do it all.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. So many places that you can check out on any of the tours for the 2018 Farm Hop series of tours coming up here. The sponsor, of course, as we mentioned, is the Northwest Indiana Food Council. Now, if anybody's interested and would like to sign up to register for any of the tours, how do they do that?
Sure. It's really easy. You can go to our website, nwifoodcouncil.org/farmhop. Our tickets are available there. Again, they're only $20, and that includes lunch. Children 12 and under are only $10.
Wow, what a great opportunity to spend a weekend, either August 11th or September 22nd, to take advantage of seeing some great farms that grow local food and have a great, I guess, in a way, local entertainment as well, too. You'll certainly enjoy the chickens, it sounds like, on the tour from Valparaiso, to be sure. We've been talking with Ann Massey. She's the president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council about this year's The second annual Farm Hop series of tours coming up here, beginning with the one on August 11th and then another tour on Saturday, September 22nd. And you can go to the Northwest Indiana Food Council's website to find out more. And it'll also direct you to how you can register for the tours if you're interested in attending the tours this year. And Ann, thank you as always for being with us to talk about this. And we hope you have a great crowd. It sounds like the first year was very successful, and the second annual session is going to be even better. So thanks for talking about those, and we hope to have you back again.
Thanks so much, Chris. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio.
This month marks the 83rd anniversary of Social Security. Just imagine, it was 1935 when the first Social Security benefit check went out. I understand to a little old lady who was a teacher, I think, if my history lesson serves me correctly here. But let's talk about the importance of Social Security, the problems that it's now going through, and your retirement budget. For that, we are turning to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, as always, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well,
how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, and probably better off than the Social Security system is. I know this is a bad year for them, I guess. Tell us why the annual cost for Social Security is kind of hitting a hallmark this year.
Well, the Social Security system is what they call pay-as-you-go system, meaning that it was never designed that the money coming out of your paycheck was going to pay your benefits. It was always designed that the people working would pay or provide the benefit, I should say, for the people receiving. And back when you said established some 83 years ago, life expectancy was nowhere near where it is today. In fact, the Roosevelt administration felt it was kind of comical that, you know, these benefits would never have a problem. But as people began to live longer, medicine has provided better value. You know, you're seeing a lot more people going well beyond the life expectancies of some 83 years ago. What's happened is it went from what used to be about 20 people working to every person receiving benefit to about 4 people working to every individual receiving benefit. And that's in large part due to the large amount of people going into it, the baby boomer generation.
So I guess it means that you have to plan things out accordingly if you're going to be hoping for Social Security to play a big role in your retirement budget, to be sure. I know one of the things that we talk about, and we've talked about this in past conversations too, is about the importance of making sure that you maximize the benefits that you get.
Absolutely, and you know, a lot of people look at it, you're still eligible to file at 62. The old full retirement of 65 that we all had as a benchmark is gone. For some that are still near it, it's 66, and maximizing benefits all the way to age 70 could be a consideration. But basically, to your point, Chris, I think individuals need to understand that if they do file early, what they're choosing to do is take a significant reduction of what they've earned. So at 62, if you were eligible at 66, you're taking a 25% reduction in benefits, which could play a significant role in the benefits that you have throughout retirement.
Are there people that are really taking their benefits at 62? I know that most people typically wait a little longer, and that's not because they've necessarily been advised to, I guess.
Yeah, and some of the challenges, you know, there'll be even times where we recommend that people do take it because, you know, particular individuals, it might be need-based. You know, they are in a trade or an occupation where physically maybe their bodies can't keep doing what they're doing, and, you know, they need to provide that income earlier, and it's rationalized and justified that way. Some people just don't realize the significance of doing it because part of the misconception out there is, you know, like you said, Social Security is now going to start to draw from that trust fund, and it's expected to be deleted by, you know, the year 2034, and individuals believe that that's the end of Social Security. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the end of Social Security. It's just without reform, there could be a reduction in benefits, and right now, without reform, it would be 77 cents on the dollar.
Now, we talk about the fact that some people have decided at age 62 to go ahead and seek their benefits, but they can, and there are ways for them to kind of reverse the decision, isn't there?
Yeah, there's actually two things that they can do. Mm-hmm. One, if they have filed and realized that, you know, long term that may not have been the best decision, and it's within 12 months, you have a once in a lifetime opportunity to what they talk about, you know, withdraw your application. Now, you do have to pay back those benefits, but you can actually withdraw the application, pay back what you received, and it would be as if you never filed. Mm-hmm. So you would go basically turn back the clock to your point, and you could begin to rethink how you want to collect it. If they are beyond that year, once they reach full retirement age, which for most people, basically for everybody that is receiving benefit right now, at age 66, they can actually suspend those payments. And from that point forward to age 70, they would resume a growth of 8% from their current benefit. So it could be a substantial increase over those years that they delay.
Okay. And also, too, we talk about what an individual needs to do on Social Security, but spouses fit into the program, too. And I guess when we're talking about the spouses, even not counting in the death benefits.
Yes, and the biggest thing with spousal planning that I tell folks is when you're looking at maximizing benefits, a lot of people will do the math, and they look at Social Security within its own silo and don't consider, you know, outside of that particular just addition of benefits. And for most people, it's going to be a break-even, as people call it, about age 78. And so a lot of individuals will be influenced by it and say, you know what, I'm going to collect. There's no guarantees I'm going to make it to age 78. But if you're married, there is a strong possibility, if you're both at reach the age 65, that one will live significantly longer than that break-even point. So even delaying one of those benefits, and generally it will be the higher benefit, should provide a lot more value for the survivor, because that's the benefit that ultimately the person that lives the longest will be receiving. And it usually represents a significant number of dollars or years that they're receiving that higher benefit.
And I know that the main point, too, is to be sure to include Social Security and the funds that you'll get from your benefits when you do find you're eligible and you do take advantage of them, to include this in as part of an overall plan for spending and for budgeting, too.
Well, and you hit it right on the head. Ultimately, what I tell individuals is you should start with a plan. You know, start with the income plan. What's important to you? What are your goals? What are your concerns? What are your priorities? And then talk about how Social Security can address those specific goals, and then look at different things. One in particular would be tax planning. You know, Social Security distribution phase is all different. Social Security may be taxable or may not be taxable. So setting up your income plan one way could cause a lot more tax ramifications versus looking at opportunities to mitigate some of those taxes, which could be critical in terms of the total dollars. It's like I always tell individuals, it's not about the gross check, it's about what you're receiving. And then just looking at other things that you might need to address because of loss of income. You know, when a spouse passes away, there's going to be a significant drop of income. They go to a single tax bracket, so they're going to be paying more taxes. So those ramifications become very significant in the overall planning process. And how you choose to collect your Social Security could directly mitigate some of that exposure.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And as always, Greg, thanks for joining us and giving us some good advice on finances.
Thanks, Chris. I enjoyed being on.
Last time we talked with this fellow was about the Gary Services Building Project in Gary, and it was a project involving the Calumet Artist Residency. Let's turn now to Sam Love, who is the president of the Calumet Artist Residency, about a couple of other new projects that are underway. Sam, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hey, it's great to talk with you again, Chris. Appreciate it.
Let's start out first about the new hashtag campaign that is underway, hashtag PublicArt219. And this, I guess, project involves, I guess, a 40-foot-long, 10-foot-tall poetry wall entitled Gary Is. Tell us the thinking behind putting up this poetry wall in Gary.
Sure. Well, I'll start with the hashtag campaign first, actually,
okay,
which is meant to draw attention to public art in Northwest Indiana, as well as sparking a dialogue about public art here. And that was devised by the Legacy Foundation, our friends down in Merrillville there. And they asked a few of us artists who work out in the public sphere what we thought, and instantly we went and tagged all of our work on social media with the hashtag, and conversations began, and lo and behold, lots of public art is starting to appear around Gary and Northwest Indiana as well. Just Gary, for instance, might be getting upwards of 60 murals in the downtown area this summer and fall.
Wow.
So our contribution, our humble contribution, yes, is a 40-foot-long, 10-foot-tall green wall with a poem cut into it entitled Gary Is. And it is composed of lines that we collected during the Gary Poetry Project last year. We collected 1,100 lines of poetry from the 67 events and workshops that we held in Gary last year. And all of these lines have the words Gary is in there. So we pulled those ones out, weave them together, and we're really pleased with the results that came out. We're proud to have that out in public. It's along Miller Avenue, about a block west of the 18th Street Brew Pub.
Wow.
So it shows the good and the bad. It shows the exceptional and the ordinary. And what we hope is that the poem, and especially putting it out there in public, sends a message that it's really hard to tell a single story about this city, no matter what's happening out here. There's a lot of life out here, and that's what sustains us. So it's a beautiful poem, and we're still basking in the glow of the Poetry Project, but we're doing the Nature Project this year, so we're still keeping up with a lot of poetry, but now we're getting outdoors even more.
Well, and we'll talk more about the Gary Nature Project in just a moment here, but you mentioned here about the fact that the Gary Poetry Project is still alive with this particular project of the Poetry Wall on Miller Avenue. I guess there's some other things there on the property, too, and I guess you have to make arrangements if you do want to see it because it is private property.
Yes, and that particular road is narrow, it curves, and it's dangerous, and people drive too fast. And a lot of pedestrians, who especially people who live in Etna in the Glen Ryan neighborhood, mm-hmm. walk through there to get to Lake Street to do their shopping and whatnot. So there's nowhere to park. I mean, people are welcome to view it, but we would ask if people want to really spend some time out there with it that they would make arrangements with us. And they can email info@calumetresidency.com. And we're out in the community just about every day that it's nice. So it's really no problem to have people come over. We're just concerned more about the safety of it. And gradually over the years, we're going to evolve this property into something that the public can use. In fact, we're going to try to engineer a path so that pedestrians can actually step a bit off this road. It's at a curve. It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I've been out
as well as beautiful.
I've been out in that area. Yeah, it's fun drive in that area. But yeah, that's pretty treacherous right there. It's a good place to see something, but you can't really slow down very much to see it. So you'd be better off to be able to park someplace and actually get to walk over to it. Yeah. Now, let's take a moment here and give credit to the folks that helped you out with the Gary Poetry Project. You mentioned about the Legacy Foundation of Northwest Indiana, which is, of course, Lake County's own community foundation. They had some outside help, I understand, in getting this project going, too. Tell us about that.
Oh, are you asking about the Knight Foundation?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's the main sponsor of the Poetry Project and both the Nature Project. It's called the Knight Donor Advisory Fund, and we applied for the Poetry Project and received a grant, and then they asked us to apply again. So we came up with the Nature Project. And this, Legacy, how this operates is they have three pillars that are at the core of their mission, and they'd like you to align. They want to, how does your project align with one or all of these pillars? So the one that we chose specifically was the civic pillar. And with what's happening in Gary this year with the comprehensive master planning that's going on, we're using the Nature Project as a way to generate awareness about the natural treasures the city of Gary has, because it's quite a few. The city never fully developed, and that left a lot of rare ecosystems, dune and swales, savannas, wetlands, and whatnot. And people, as history shows us, people fight like hell here and throughout Northwest Indiana to protect that. So we want to highlight Gary's role in those struggles to conserve the environment, and it's still going on today. The kids down at Steel City Academy are doing a great job with that. But also things like taking kids who've never been to the lakeshore in Gary and making sure that through their youth group or their summer program that they and their friends get a chance to have that experience. And we brought the summer youth group from the Gary Historical and Cultural Society to Marquette Park. We had a wonderful intergenerational group, probably from 5 up to, I don't want to date anybody, but a lot of wisdom there, and it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. We are very, very grateful to Knight and Legacy for seeing the value in this. And then we tie it back to that civic pillar by getting people to talk and discuss, reflect upon their environment and what they'd like to see happen. And then that information is going to get communicated directly to the city, to the redevelopment department, to the planning department, to the mayor, to the city council, and everybody. It's a completely public process, and we'll have news about meetings in the city coming up. So
now, you mentioned about the track to the lakefront by the youngsters involved in the Gary Historical and Cultural Society. When they went out to Marquette Park, did they do some interesting things out there? Did they just check the lakefront out? Did they go to like the Douglas Center or places out there within the area to enjoy not only the flora and the fauna, but just the nice day out there?
It was beautiful. They got right to work at playing. I mean, it is such a wonderful thing to see youth without anything but their imaginations, their bodies, and the environment just set about organizing themselves and playing. I mean, we were out there for 4 hours. There was no fighting. There was just smiles the whole time. I mean, we have little kids and teenagers, right? Teenagers are supposed to be sullen and too cool, but they just occupied themselves, and I was able to relax and enjoy myself because, of course, we adults are responsible for their safety. And we taught them that the lake is a dangerous and powerful yet beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And then, yes, we did get to take them to the Douglas Center. In fact, they demanded to go to the Douglas Center.
Oh, really?
So we had to oblige.
Wow.
Yeah, every time I volunteer or work with young people in nature out here, they, what is this lupin flower and this Carter butterfly? You must take us to see these things. So that's why we did this project. The demand is there. The knowledge is there. We didn't get taught this in schools. We did not get taught that Gary was where the science of ecology was born here. And rather than be bitter about that, we're going to do our part to expose everybody to the wonders that are here and help interpret it and help them connect with it.
Now,
we've had many partners this year, Field Museum, yeah, Nature Conservancy, the list goes on and on.
Now, Sam, and see, that shows that as grown-ups, you remember these things and you know that your responsibility is to direct the young people that come after us into taking advantage of these opportunities, because that's the only way that they ever survive and ever continue on when they grow up. And hopefully they'll be able to follow your steps and take groups out to Marquette Park, to the Douglas Center, and then have a chance to take advantage of these youth programs too. Now, you mentioned about the Gary Nature Project being involved in this one particular nature education project with the Gary Parks Department with their summer program. Is there anything else that you have in mind or that you're working with the Parks Department on here for the rest of the summer?
It's developing, I suppose, and I think that there's going to be a lot of good energy and organization coming out. Nate George, the superintendent, actually was one of the first people I met when I started as a community organizer here,
mm-hmm,
and he was as well. So that relationship and, you know, that trust is already in place. There's also opportunities through federal programs to get a lot more funding. And just the short of it is, if we do a great job this summer and can document, you know, what we did with this summer youth program, there's opportunities to get even more funding to continue this on year round. So continued engagement through the public parks is definitely, I think, in the best interest of everybody. And we're lucky, you know, mayor is aware of these things and she is actively encouraging that. So it's good that we don't have to fight the elected officials on that front. You know, we're on the same side on this one, so we can get more done.
Sam Love, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about these projects in particular, and we hope to have you back on again and talk a little bit more detail, especially if you have more great summer projects involving the young people of the city of Gary.
Will do. I always appreciate it.
Sam Love is the president of the Calumet Artist Residency. China isn't going to take trash from the U.S. anymore. Last year, the country announced it will no longer import America's contaminated recyclables. And with nowhere to go, the question is, what becomes of all that material? Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports that Hoosiers are looking for ways to prevent potential recyclables from ending up in a landfill.
For some folks in rural Johnson County, these drop-off bins were the only way they could recycle. But today, they're not there anymore. The county discontinued them July 31st. The recycling district couldn't afford to pay haulers to take them. Executive Director Jesse Biggerman says no one supervised the bins, so the recycling often got contaminated with things like greasy pizza boxes. Now that China won't take low-quality recycling, Biggerman says the material in bins like these isn't valuable anymore. And if no one wants it,
then unfortunately, those items will sit idle. And at some point, they will find their way, either contaminating, you know, the environment around them, or going back into a landfill.
Few recycling districts have had to stop service. But others have decided that, like China, they simply can't accept some items anymore. Greene County stopped taking glass, and Monroe County won't recycle plastic bags and shrink wrap. Eliza Pokrell is the community outreach coordinator for the Monroe County Solid Waste District.
There's too much, okay, and the recyclers who handle that do not want to deal with it because they don't have any place for it, and we don't have a vendor for it.
While the value of U.S. recycling is low, the cost to process it has gone up, and that cost gets passed down to Hoosiers. Brownstown, which has less than 3,000 people, is a bit luckier. It only had to increase its rates by 50 cents a month. But Clerk Treasurer David Willey says the town just raised them 2 years ago to get larger recycle bins.
The time before we went to the carts, a lot of people, you know, didn't like that big of an increase.
Some of Indiana's recycling gets sorted here at Rumpke's Material Recovery Facility in Cincinnati, Ohio. Steve Sargent is the company's director of recycling. He says China's standards are much stricter than what the U.S. recycling industry is used to. No more than 0.5% of the material can be contaminated.
Can our industry hit that on a consistent basis? No, we can't.
So what's the solution? Sargent says U.S. consumers need to start treating recyclables less like trash and more like what they are, products. Take cardboard, for example. By itself, recycled cardboard is very valuable, especially with the rise of companies like Amazon. But Sargent says when that cardboard gets jumbled together with other things, it becomes dirt cheap mixed paper.
The value of mixed paper today on the index, which we sell against, is zero. Now, you can't make much money when you're selling 30% of your mix in a recycling plant at zero.
Sargent says he gets it. People want to recycle as much as they can. But when folks throw the wrong items in the bin, they risk sending more recyclables to the landfill. Sargent says the industry needs to find a better way to teach people what's recyclable and what's not.
You're going to see a much more standardized message, a very basic message. So we want plastic bottles and jugs, small mouth, large body. We don't want tubs, we don't want butter dishes, we don't want all this food packaging waste. That's the material that's been contaminating us.
And if Hoosiers can manage to keep their recyclables clean, there may be a silver lining here. Allison Mitchell is the executive director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. She says with some improvements, Indiana could process this excess recycling right here. The issue then would become making sure there are markets that want it.
One really easy way to do that is just to support and purchase from manufacturers who use recycled content in their products.
Sargent says adapting to the China ban won't be cheap, but that Rumpke has invested too much not to give it a shot. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Experts say that single-stream recycling, where people put all types of recyclables in one bin, can further contaminate the load. The Johnson County Recycling District has considered switching back to dual-stream recycling. That is where paper and cardboard are separated from other recyclables. Brandon Warren is an 18-year-old from Indianapolis who became an anti-violence activist after he lost a friend. He was recently recognized as one of the nation's top youth volunteers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan recently sat down with Warren to talk about the root causes of youth violence ahead of the second annual peace walk for his group, We Live Indy.
You became involved in the youth violence effort
after
a personal story.
Yeah, May of 2017, when I lost a friend and classmate of mine and a teammate of mine by the name of DeJohn Anderson, I was motivated to become active in the community. And I wanted to do something that created unity throughout the city, and Peace Walk was the first thing that really came to mind. You know, we're just trying to keep that same message and build that on top of the message of the youth violence that creates in the urban communities. You know, we realize that this isn't just about school shootings or just urban community shootings. This is about all youth violence as a whole, from suicide to drug overdose and everything. We really just want to be vocal teenagers, and that's what we're just trying to build, vocal teenagers to speak up on the youth violence issues that's creating.
No, those issues can be so complicated.
Yes.
And so, you know, deep-rooted. With your personal experience, you know, where did it go wrong at your high school and with your peers that something like this happened?
You know, the big things wise, I feel that shootings like this happen is because of the relationships that the victim or the students may have. One example is teacher-student relationship. I feel that is so powerful. Imagine if every teenager felt that they had someone behind them to support them. Imagine if every teenager had that influence that was constantly in their ear telling them right from wrong. With my friend, his mother speaks up on it all the time. She was a single mother and she was working nights at the time, and it was really hard for her to be that influence in her son's ear, especially as he was a senior in high school and, you know, just leading with the wrong crowd at the wrong time. And that easily could have been guided a different direction.
Indianapolis heading for another record year of violence. And we so often hear, you know, that it's a 14-year-old, it's a 15-year-old.
I feel like I'm not the only teenager that's become numb to this. And when I have the feeling where I become numb to this and so used to it, and, you know, it's really hard to show emotions because, you know, I feel that it's no progress when you feel that way. But there's another side of me that tells me, you know, when we do peace marches, when we speak up on the issues, when we go to news interviews, when we are vocal, that's a small step forward.
The incident in Noblesville, right, and the reality that this can happen anywhere.
Man. We focus on this, you know, should we focus on mental health? Should we focus on, you know, getting the kids more resources? Should we focus on trying to find out where they're getting the guns? You know, so many different things. But I feel like the pillar of them all, the circle of them all, is actually talking to these kids, actually getting their lives. You know, a lot of the kids aren't going to be vocal unless you come to them.
Mm-hmm. How'd the walk go last year?
Man, it was great. You know, it was a hot day, but it was so powerful. You know, one of the most powerful things was hearing Mayor Hawks speak, Congressman Andre Carson, and really just the victimized families speak. And that was the most powerful thing to me last year, walking down Keystone and having the officers block off a section of the street while cars are still able to drive by and honk their horns and recognize us. Honestly, the most influential thing to me of the walk last year that will happen this year again, when we stopped in front of the juvenile center on 25th and Keystone, we had a real quick visual prayer word, because I want the kids to know inside. I want them to know that no matter what they're inside for, that they have a second or third or however many opportunity they have to get right and be with us outside eventually down the line.
Thank you, Brandon, so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan talking to youth activist Brandon Warren. The peace walk that he's referred to is Saturday, August 11th at 11 a.m., and it starts and ends at Washington Park in Indianapolis. A new report says Indiana's making progress to close achievement gaps in higher education, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us, some groups are still lagging behind.
The Commission for Higher Education wants at least 60% of Hoosiers to have some kind of college credential by 2025. That includes a push to close achievement gaps for low-income and minority students. Commissioner Teresa Lubbers says the state's 21st Century Scholars Program that offers low-income students free college tuition is showing major progress.
We are not where we need to be, but with the 21st Century Scholars population, we in fact are showing that we would close the achievement gap by 2025.
But some gaps remain. Hispanic students still go to college less than white and black students, and only around 30% of black students from Indiana High School's 2015 cohort completed all of the coursework they attempted during their first year at college in the state. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly talked about health care while he's on the campaign trail on Friday as he makes his pitch for re-election. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter Brandon Smith reports that Democrats are seizing on the issue in what they hope is a winning strategy this election cycle.
Hoosier Republicans didn't lose many elections in recent years when they ran on pledges to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But Congress spent the last year and a half trying and mostly failing to do away with the law and replace it with a new system. Senator Joe Donnelly says voters notice.
It's contributed to the problems that we have in health care, where you look and there's questions about whether pre-existing condition coverage will continue.
Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun is clear. He wants to dismantle the ACA. He says the challenge is a replacement.
Typical liberal or the Democrat plan is whatever it costs, try to do it. That's played out in front of us and it's falling apart.
Braun says conservatives don't talk enough about the need for reform within the healthcare insurance industry. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Thousands of attendees played hundreds of games over 4 days at the 51st Gen Con in Indianapolis last week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports that this year Gen Con made some new efforts to reduce the carbon footprint of one of Indiana's largest conventions.
From the saran wrap to the cardboard, new games can come with a lot of packaging. Gen Con President David Hoppe says this year it is rolling out unboxing stations for gamers to be able to recycle unwanted packaging.
People can go and open up their games, put all their packaging into appropriate recyclable containers, and then just take the parts that they want to go back with them, and the rest of that all gets recycled.
Deanna Davis from Dayton, Ohio, is a 10-year Gen Con veteran.
I like that it's next to the library where new games are unpackaged probably more frequently, and I think it's clever. I like it.
Hoppe says the convention also repurposed former Gen Con banners into bags and wallets. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Time for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Amy Davis Navardauskas, the marketing director for the Lebesnik Center for the Arts in Michigan City. Welcome back, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and you have, last week we talked about the Chesterton Art Fair, and now we have, is yours called the Lebesnik Art Fair?
It's called the Lebesnik Arts Festival.
Arts Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that's different.
A little bit.
So when is the Lebesnik Arts Festival this year?
It's August 18th and 19th.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
And how many artists do you typically have in the festival?
We actually have quite a few more artists this year. I think we had about 60 to 70, and mm-hmm. we're going to be closer to 80 this year. So, we're really excited. We were able to grow our footprint a mm-hmm. little bit.
And you had moved it a couple of years ago mm-hmm. from the Washington Park.
Yes.
To where it had been since time began.
Yeah.
To the Lebesnik.
To our grounds.
Yeah, to your grounds.
Yeah.
And and you have interesting sculpture there anyway.
We do. We have some nice sculptures and a nice piece by Yeppe Hine.
Yeah.
It's kind of a mirror piece.
Yeah,
it's outside.
I love that work.
Yeah.
What all goes on at the festival?
Okay, so we have our artist booths, mm-hmm. which is very art fair. Esque.
Mm-hmm.
So we have about 80 artists that'll be there. We have several community partners that will be there as well, people from the Michigan City area community to represent either an arts component or a community component
uh-huh.
that kind of meshes with our festival. And I believe we're going to have an artist that is painting henna, so you can get your,
tattoo.
Yeah, henna tattoo.
Yeah.
So
not permanent.
Not permanent. Just I think it lasts about a week to 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of cool. A major element of the festival will be inside the art center where we have the Andy Warhol Icon and Influence exhibition. So that's a great opportunity to see some iconic work.
Well, let's talk about that since
sure.
you brought it up.
Yeah,
that's a big show
yeah.
for you that opened earlier this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was 2 years in the making.
Mm-hmm.
So we've known about it for quite some time, and we were kind of waiting for some pieces and grant funding to fall into place
mm-hmm.
before we could kind of announce that we were going to be doing it. But we have works on loan from Wendy and Drew Levenfeld, who
mm-hmm.
are people that live in the area. And then also the Brower Museum of Art has
mm-hmm.
an extensive collection of photographs, Polaroids
mm-hmm.
and black and whites, that kind of help fill out the exhibition. So
the Polaroids are source material for Warhol and his art making.
Yeah. So he went around and snapped all kinds of pictures of famous people and not famous people. He just took lots of pictures.
He took advantage of the technology, as it were, that was available to him at the time, and which was
yeah.
so new.
Yeah.
And quick. Instant. Yes.
Yeah.
And his subject matter, of course, there were the celebrities he portrayed.
Right.
But then his subject matter, like Campbell's soup cans.
Yeah.
You have Campbell's soup cans.
Yeah, we have one of the Campbell's soup cans, the onion soup.
Onion soup.
Yum.
But you also have in this exhibit younger artists who have been influenced by his art production.
Yeah, we have five artists, it's very interesting how they help to fill in the exhibition. Mm-hmm. So there's an installation piece by Yvette Mayorga. Mm-hmm. That's really fantastic. She actually showed at Expo Chicago last year, and her mm-hmm. work is our installation room is painted this Pepto-Bismol pink, if you mm-hmm. can imagine, and then there's all these different elements that are kind of constructed with frosting and sculptures, and she had a rug handmade, and so it's in the subject matter. Yeah, it's very inviting and kind of fluffy sounding, but the subject matter is pretty serious. It has to do with that Mexican American border.
I see.
Tension. So
yeah,
it's very heady stuff, but it's very inviting to walk into.
So it lures you in, but then
there's meaning here.
So let's get back. So the Warhol. No, I know. The Warhol show is up through
October 13th.
Okay.
So festival goers will be able to, walk around and they'll be able to take that exhibition.
And is there a fee for getting into the festival? Or do you just
arrive? for art members, it is not. So if mm-hmm. you're a member of Lebesnik Center, there's no fee. But for non-members, it's just $5 mm-hmm. to get in, and that benefits mm-hmm. Lebesnik Center mm-hmm. for the Arts and the programming we deliver year round. So,
and there'll be lots of good food there, I would imagine.
There will be. There's some delicious food, and we've planned a fun kind of a scavenger hunt for kids to take part in this year. So there'll be a lot of stuff for families to do.
Great. Yeah. Well, Amy, thanks for being here to tell us about it. Good luck with the festival.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And this conversation and other previous editions of Eye on the Arts are online on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.